Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, November 25th, 2025. And here are today's news briefs. Mormon Church lowers missionary age for women. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints said women can serve as missionaries at age 18, 1 year younger than the previous standard. The number of women wanting to serve a mission has risen for 10 years, according to the church. The new policy brings the age for female missionaries in line with that for men, though men's missions are 6 months longer. The new age standard is one of the first changes announced since the denomination named a new president and prophet, Dallin Oaks, last month. Staff. Fishers rescued after 20 hours at sea. The U.S. Coast Guard sprang into action after a recreational fishing vessel failed to return from a fishing trip off Clearwater, Florida. On Tuesday, the Coast Guard located the boat's four crew members atop their capsized boat in rough seas, 26 miles off Clearwater Pass. The men had been stranded for over 20 hours by the time they were rescued. They could be seen embracing family members upon their return to Sand Cay in a Miami-based HC-144 Ocean Sentry aircraft. Staff. Peace plan for Sudan in flux. Neither group in Sudan's war has accepted a U.S.-backed peace plan. The Sudanese army says the latest plan, also supported by the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, undercuts its role and gives legitimacy to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF. The RSF says it has agreed to an immediate unilateral ceasefire, but whether it will hold is unclear, given the group has previously violated the deal. U.S. officials say they hope this ceasefire lasts, following President Donald Trump's pledge last week to step in and try to end the conflict. New suspects arrested in the Louvre heist case. French police arrested four new suspects in connection with the spectacular daytime heist of the Louvre Museum in Paris last month. While the two men and two women are now in custody, the stolen royal jewels, worth an estimated $102 million, have not yet been recovered. The new arrests hold to the four suspects already charged. France's highest audit court has called the robbery a deafening wake-up call for museum security. Staff. Donald Trump and Xi Jinping speak about Taiwan. President Donald Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping spoke by phone Monday, a month after meeting in person in South Korea. Mr. Xi said Taiwan's return to mainland China is an integral part of the post-war international order. Washington remains opposed to China using force to take control of the island, whose independence is contested. Nevertheless, Mr. Trump called the relationship extremely strong and said he accepted an invitation to visit Beijing in the spring. Staff. Pentagon launches investigation of a senator. The Pentagon is investigating Senator Mark Kelly for posting a video with six other lawmakers reminding U.S. troops that they can refuse illegal orders. The review, announced in a social media post Monday, fueled concerns that the Trump administration is using the Pentagon to intimidate critics. A retired Navy officer, Senator Kelly, could be recalled to active duty and prosecuted, the Pentagon indicated. The Arizona Democrat said in a statement that members of Congress will not be silenced by bullies. Staff. Israeli military commanders fired. Israel's military chief of staff informed several top military commanders they were being removed for failing to prevent the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack and protect their fellow citizens once the surprise assault began. It follows a recent ceasefire that halted the Gaza war. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government is under public pressure to establish a state commission of inquiry into the deadliest day in Israeli history. Staff. Our first article today is, as Trump's power has risen, so has his wealth, and in all in plain sight. By Linda Feldman, staff writer, Washington. When President Donald Trump pardoned billionaire Changpeng Zhao on October 21st, controversy surrounding the cryptocurrency mogul's ties with the Trump family had already been swirling for months. Mr. Zhao, founder and former chief executive of Binance, the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange, had served 4 months in prison in 2024 after pleading guilty to violating U.S. regulations against money laundering. The Binance platform had accommodated criminals across the world, according to then Attorney General Merrick Garland. After serving his time, Mr. Zhao would still benefit from a pardon because of ongoing legal constraints on his business activities. "No felon would mind a pardon," he said in a March post on X, while also saying, "I've had no discussions of a Binance U.S. deal for a pardon." But that same month, a different deal did happen. A sovereign wealth fund from the United Arab Emirates invested $2 billion in Binance, transferring the invested money in the form of a digital coin called USD1. It's a product created and sold by the Trump family's cryptocurrency firm, World Liberty Financial. Coming in the early weeks of President Trump's second term, the influx of money represented a huge vote of confidence in world liberty and its fledgling coin. It also drew scrutiny from Mr. Trump's critics. They saw the actions as efforts by Mr. Zhao, Binance, and the United Arab Emirates to influence the president to their advantage. Since then, Mr. Zhao, who holds citizenship in Canada, France, and the United Arab Emirates, has received a pardon, and the UAE has won a deal for advanced computer chips. No evidence has emerged of a quid pro quo connection in all these actions. But the events are part of a larger pattern. Money is flowing to Trump family businesses and other Trump-related activities, often coming from entities that stand to benefit when Mr. Trump, as president, treats them favorably. The White House insists there are no conflicts of interest, yet, for watchdog groups and many in the general public, the appearances raise questions. What is at stake, according to experts on ethics, are the nation's long-standing norms and guidelines that elected officials and public servants are expected to follow. The founders were very clear about the necessity for public officials to not be making profits on the side, says Robert McGuire, research director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, C-R-E-W. Today, he says, there's a violation of long-established expectations that the president should avoid the appearance of acting in his own financial interest rather than the national interest. The issue is rising for at least two broad reasons. One is an unusually large tide of gifts towards projects such as Mr. Trump's presidential library or his addition of a ballroom to the White House now underway. The other is that his family remains active in global business activities that stand to benefit the president financially, even though he says he has recused himself from any direct management role. Gifts are triggering alarm bells among some ethics experts who ask what donors might want in return for their contributions. The alarms get louder when the president himself and his family appear to benefit financially. Over the past year, cryptocurrency has become much more lucrative as one of those family businesses. On May 5th, after the $2 billion Emirati investment deal occurred, two Democratic U.S. senators posted a letter to the acting director of the Office of Governmental Ethics, Jamison Greer, outlining what they called a matter with urgent ethics and national security implications involving a crypto firm whose founder needs a pardon. We write to request an urgent inquiry into a billion-dollar business deal involving the state-backed Emirati investment firm MGX, crypto exchange Binance, and World Liberty Financial, WLF, that is poised to enrich President Trump and his family, as well as the family of Special Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, said Senators Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Some pieces of context. World Liberty Financial earns interest on the reserve assets that back customers' holdings in the WLF stablecoin, USD1, so the Emirati fund's investment in Binance also benefits the Trump family, as long as those assets are denominated in WLF's coin. Mr. Witkoff's son, Zach, is a manager at WLF alongside Mr. Trump's sons, Donald Jr. and Eric. Weeks after that letter was sent, Mr. Trump announced that his administration had agreed to create a path for UAE to buy some of the world's most advanced AI semiconductors from American companies. And on October 21st, he pardoned Mr. Zhao. In an interview on CBS's 60 Minutes that aired on November 2nd, Mr. Trump played down any relationship with Mr. Zhao, saying he had no idea who the man was. Asked 2 days later about that statement at a White House briefing, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said the president meant that he does not know him personally. When it comes to pardons, the White House takes them with the utmost seriousness, and the president understands the responsibility that he has as president to issue clemency and issue pardons to individuals who are seeking that, Ms. Leavitt continued, citing a very thorough review process for such requests. In a Fox News interview on November 7th, Mr. Zhao denied having ties to the Trump family and said he had never met Mr. Trump. Binance's current CEO, Richard Teng, denies that the company promoted a Trump-linked cryptocurrency before Mr. Zhao's pardon. 5 days after the pardon, Binance announced an expanded partnership with the World Liberty Financial. Throughout U.S. history, presidents have had their share of ethical scrutiny and scandals. What's remarkable now is a confluence of unusual factors. Mr. Trump is serving as president even as his family remains highly active in a range of U.S. and global businesses. The president repeatedly disregards established norms, an issue that emerged early in Mr. Trump's first term, promoting the director of the Office of Government Ethics to resign at the time. His party, over which he has great sway, controls both houses of Congress. He has dismantled some traditional modes of ethics oversight. Together, these circumstances create what some observers see as an unprecedented opening for potential or actual corruption, combined with a projected air of normality around whatever actions Mr. Trump takes. The result, as critics see it, is an open door to a pay-to-play presidency. Much of the question arising activity has happened in plain sight. That is part of the genius of what he does, says Kathleen Clark, a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis and an expert on government ethics. By doing it out in the open, many people think it can't possibly be corrupt. Yet, in her view, Professor Clark says in an email, the president has effectuated a hostile takeover of the federal government, establishing a corrupt, personalist regime where government action is determined not by the law, but by what pleases him. Forbes magazine now estimates Mr. Trump's net worth at about $6.3 billion, more than double where it stood in early 2024, largely a result of the growth in the family's crypto ventures. Meanwhile, as in his first term, Mr. Trump has said he's again not taking his presidential salary of $400,000 a year. Crypto isn't the only arena in which public concerns have surfaced about conflicts of interest within the Trump administration. Researchers on the issue say it is often hard to know whether flows of money have resulted in improper influence on U.S. policy. Influences might exist without any overt quid pro quo deal, and thus can be hard to trace or prove. Some examples that hint at both the risks and the blurry lines are Trump meme coins. In May, the president held a gala dinner for the biggest buyers of a Trump-branded niche cryptocurrency, meme coins. The highest high-roller billionaire, Justin Sun, bought more than $40 million in Trump coins. Before and shortly after the 2024 election, Mr. Sun invested $75 million in the Trump family's crypto business, WLF. In February, shortly after Mr. Trump retook office, the Securities and Exchange Commission paused an investigation into Mr. Sun and his companies over allegations of market manipulation. Another one is the White House ballroom. Construction of a 900,000-square-foot, $300 million event space has begun, with last month's raising of the East Wing. Mr. Trump has long sought such an addition and pledged no public money would go towards the project. That has opened the door to private donors, from major corporations to wealthy individuals to unnamed entities, individuals and companies, who can potentially benefit by currying favor with the president. The White House promised transparency over the ballroom's funding and released a list of donors, though not their donation amounts. But the identities of several donors remain off the record, including some with business before the administration, according to the New York Times. Mr. Trump also hosted a thank you dinner in the White House with some media access for high-dollar supporters. Another one is golden gifts from Switzerland. On November 14th, the Trump administration announced a deal to lower U.S. tariffs against Swiss imports from 39% to 15%. That followed a visit from Swiss business executives on November 4th, bearing gifts for the president, including a Rolex desk clock and a 1 kilogram personalized gold bar, according to news reports. The gifts will go to Mr. Trump's presidential library, White House officials say. Then there's the Boeing 747 gift from Qatar. The White House said in May that the luxury jet was a donation to the Department of Defense and will be transferred to Mr. Trump's presidential library after he leaves office. Democrats argue that the gift violates the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits federal office holders from accepting gifts from foreign states. Senate Democrats have tried unsuccessfully to prevent the administration from spending hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to transform the jet into a new Air Force One. They say it's a hugely wasteful effort if the plane is to be retired from federal service in 2029. Then there's the overture from Serbia. On November 7th, the Serbian government passed a special law smoothing the way for a roughly $500 million Trump hotel project in Belgrade. Under a development company run by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. In a June interview with BBC, Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić voiced support for the proposed hotel and added, "We're ready to build better relations with the U.S. I think that is terribly important for this country." But Mr. Vučić's government has faced its own controversy, public protests against alleged corruption, and outcries against this deal in particular, which involves building a hotel on a historic site. In all, Ethics Watchdog Crew counts 23 Trump-branded real estate projects outside the U.S. that are underway during Mr. Trump's current term. As a result, the president's namesake private company, which he still owns and profits from, is free to do business in foreign countries while Trump is in office, a crew report says. The report argues that this results in massive conflicts between his personal interests and those of the nation he leads. Democrats are not immune from the appearance of pay to play. During Joe Biden's presidency, his son Hunter Biden and his brothers Frank and James Biden all came under legal scrutiny for allegedly leveraging the family name for financial gain, dating back to Joe Biden's days as vice president. Last year, the GOP-run House Oversight Committee concluded that Biden family members and associates had received more than $27 million from foreign sources as part of a conspiracy to monetize Mr. Biden's Office of Public Trust. After the Oversight Committee released its report, the Biden White House issued a statement rejecting the report's conclusions, calling the impeachment inquiry a failed stunt. Media fact-check articles on the probe found Republicans made false and misleading claims. Regardless, trackers such as Mr. McGuire say the amounts of money flowing currently are unprecedented compared with past administrations of either party. In January, before Mr. Trump's second inauguration, the family business, the Trump Organization, announced that his children would handle daily management of the president's businesses. His investments and assets would remain in trust, also managed by his children. Finance experts say that putting his personal assets in a blind trust, as a number of presidents have done in recent decades, would be difficult for Mr. Trump, because his real estate assets would need to be sold to accomplish that. President Trump is the most transparent president of all time and follows all applicable federal and ethics laws, and there are no conflicts of interest, Davis Engel, the White House spokesman, told the Monitor in a written statement on November 7th. Watchdog groups beg to differ. From a government ethics point of view, Mr. Trump has taken us back over 50 years to the Watergate era, where there is a distrust that officials at the highest level of government are truly making decisions for the public good, as opposed to their own personal profits, says Kedrick Payne, a senior director of ethics at the Campaign Legal Center in Washington. Unlike past post-era presidencies, including his own first term in the White House, Mr. Trump declined to issue an ethics pledge for his second term. Nor has there an ethics pledge for the transition process that launched when he was elected again last November. After retaking office in January, Mr. Trump also rescinded the ethics rules put in place by Mr. Biden when he was president. Another big shift in the legal landscape, last year's Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity shields U.S. chief executives from prosecution for official acts, which can be defined broadly. Where the justices will draw the boundaries remains to be seen, but the ruling clearly reduces legal checks on presidential powers. Other ethical and legal guardrails are also gone. At various federal agencies, 29 of 38 inspector general positions are vacant as of October 21st. Including the 17 left empty after firings by Mr. Trump in January. In February, the president also fired the Biden-era director of the Office of Governmental Ethics, a five-year position established in 1978, post-Watergate. The role is meant to prevent conflicts of interest within the executive branch, though the president is largely exempt from OGE oversight. A series of acting OGE directors have been filling the post. During Mr. Trump's first term, ethics watchdogs reported that foreign governments and others purchased services from Trump businesses, including hotels, restaurants, and golf courses, arguing that this violated the Constitution's Foreign Emoluments Clause, which bars officials from accepting gifts from foreign governments. After Mr. Trump left office in 2021, the Supreme Court vacated lower court rulings as moot. According to the 2023 analysis by CREW, The president made up to $160 million from foreign countries during his first term, and now, with no emoluments cases pending, it remains unclear when or if the public will find out whether such income is legal, said Mr. McGuire, the Crew Research Director. It's also unclear how or whether the other ways Mr. Trump is making money while serving as president might be checked, including sales of things such as Trump-branded Bibles, sneakers, and cologne. At this point, what, if anything, can serve as a break on what some legal scholars see as unethical presidential behavior, beyond a president's own moral compass and the tone he or she sets? The two biggest checks are public opinion and Congress, say ethics experts. While voters will always have a mix of issues on their minds, ethics is one of them, as polls attest. Midterm elections for control of Congress are a year away. U.S., Ukraine find common ground on peace. Will Russia join them? By Howard LaFrenchie, staff writer. President Donald Trump's central second-term goals, ending the war in Ukraine and repairing relations with Moscow, have led to another stab at peace plan in a roller coaster year of diplomatic efforts on the nearly four-year-old European conflict. After a flurry of hush-hush talks that stretched from Florida earlier this month to Geneva over this past weekend, and then to Abu Dhabi, it appeared the parties could be on the cusp of Mr. Trump's much-desired ceasefire. But then, maybe not as close as things had appeared. By Tuesday afternoon, President Trump offered his Truth Social followers a long post in which he said that, despite tremendous progress over the last week towards ending the war, he would be relegating continued diplomacy on the issue to advisors. He would enter the negotiations personally only when the deal to end this war is final or in its final stages. Mr. Trump said he was directing his chief negotiator, Steve Witkoff, to meet with the Russian President Vladimir Putin and Secretary of the Army Dan Driscoll to meet with the Ukrainian side. Moreover, he said he hoped he would be able to meet soon with Mr. Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, but only when a deal was sealed or very near it. That laid to rest speculation that Mr. Zelensky would meet with Mr. Trump, perhaps at the president's Mar-a-Lago estate, by the end of the week. Less than 40 hours earlier, Mr. Trump had cited big progress on Truth Social and said something good might be happening. In Kyiv, National Security Advisor Rustem Umerov said on Tuesday that Ukraine had reached a common understanding on the core terms of an agreement with the U.S. and European officials. Despite the fresh momentum towards a deal, the earlier ups and downs of the year have left officials cautious. That included Mr. Trump, who advised his Truth Social readers, "Don't believe it until you see it." Over the last week, an American 28-point plan that read like a Russian wish list was transformed by U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators into a 19-point plan more amenable to Ukrainian interests. The catch is that the whittled-down plan leaves several of the thorniest issues, including territorial concessions on Ukraine's part, the size of Ukraine's army after the war, and NATO's relationship with Ukraine, to be addressed by Mr. Trump and President Zelensky. It remained unclear on Tuesday when the two leaders would meet. Some of the Ukrainian leader's top aides reportedly advised their boss against a trip to Washington, given Mr. Trump's mercurial nature. Indeed, the record of face-to-face encounters between the two leaders over the past 9 months offers no reliable clue as to how a discussion on such critical issues might go, some experts say. It's all a question of what Trump's mood is on the day Zelensky meets with him, says Rajan Menon, a senior researcher scholar at Columbia University's Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies. It could be an opportunity for Zelensky to demonstrate to Trump that he embraces his efforts and win Trump over to his side, or it could go terribly wrong and end up the kind of split that Russian leader Vladimir Putin is hoping to see, he adds. It will come down to which Donald Trump Zelensky meets with when he arrives, Mr. Menon says. Perhaps the one constant over this year has been Mr. Trump's unwavering insistence on ending the war, thus bolstering his image as a peacemaker. For a brief period over this summer, the president had suggested he was washing his hands of the war, saying he wished both countries well while leaving them to fight it out and kill each other. But with a Gaza ceasefire agreement under his belt, the president directed his chief peace negotiator, business associate Steve Witkoff, to reach a deal in Ukraine before Thanksgiving. The original 28-point plan that Mr. Witkoff worked out with the Russian counterpart echoed Mr. Trump's Alaska summit with Mr. Putin, which appeared to many to end with the U.S. president fully in Russia's court. Some U.S. analysts and even a few Republican congressional leaders said the plan appeared to have been authored by Russian officials in Moscow. In a social media post on Sunday night, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky said that those who think pressuring the victim and appeasing the aggressor will bring peace are kidding themselves. But the weekend talks in Geneva ended with both the American and Ukrainian sides hailing the Secretary of State Marco Rubio, called tremendous progress in refining the original language to address Ukraine's chief concerns. That recalled Mr. Trump's shift to a more pro-Ukrainian stance after a June NATO summit, at which he expressed his disappointment with Mr. Putin for not matching his pledges with actions. President Trump's renewed enthusiasm for a Ukraine peace deal appears to have been fed by a sense in the White House that a vulnerable Ukraine and a politically weakened Mr. Zelensky had little choice but to accept concessions. The situation on the ground in Ukraine continues to deteriorate. The military is having trouble with desertions, and now Zelensky has a very big corruption scandal on his hands, points out Michael Desch, an international affairs professor at the University of Notre Dame. I don't know what chips Ukraine has at this point, he adds, and I think the Trump folks know that. Even more critically, it appears White House officials concluded that Ukraine was never going to retake the parts of the eastern Donbas region that Russia has occupied and would very likely lose the rest of it in continued bloody fighting. A proposal in the original plan that Ukraine should cede to Russia what would become a demilitarized zone, seen by many as a cherry on the top of the Russian wish list, appears now to have been dropped. But it remains unclear what proposal on territorial concessions the two presidents will work from when they meet. The trick for Mr. Zelensky, whenever he again meets Mr. Trump, Mr. Menon says, will be to demonstrate that he is on board with the U.S. peace plan, even as he resists any provisions that for Ukraine would be tantamount to abject surrender. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org, then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Will AI rules stifle innovation? Inside the tussle between states and the federal government. By Caitlin Babcock, staff writer. Artificial intelligence is becoming an integral part of daily life for most Americans as they interact with chatbots, read summaries of Google searches, or receive personalized recommendations from social media algorithms. The widespread use in the booming industry around it is raising the question of who gets to shape the rules for the transformative technology. The federal government, which argues that too much regulation could hinder innovation, or individual states, which have begun to pass laws primarily designed to protect AI users from things like discrimination or dangerous suggestions from chatbots. It's a battle playing out in the government right now. Some Republicans in Congress are reportedly trying to insert a moratorium on state AI regulations into a must-pass defense spending bill that lawmakers aim to approve by the end of the year. At the same time, President Donald Trump has drafted an executive order that would pressure states to back off enforcing any regulations the administration deems burdensome, according to the news reports. Investment in AI is helping to make the U.S. economy the hottest in the world, but overregulation by the states is threatening to undermine this major growth engine, President Trump wrote on social media last week. Punchbowl News reported last week that House Republicans are urging the White House to hold off on an executive order while they try to negotiate a compromise. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick has meanwhile told tech industry officials that the administration will act on its own if Congress isn't making progress. A recent Gallup poll shows that most Americans agree that the U.S. should have more advanced technologies than other countries, but 97% say that AI should be subject to regulation. Across the country, rules are taking shape. Lawmakers in all 50 states have introduced AI-related regulations, and at least 38 states have already enacted AI-related laws this year. Many of them say it's an essential to be able to respond quickly and nimbly to the ever-shifting challenge posed by AI. The states are the laboratories of democracy, says Democrat James Maroney, a Connecticut state senator who sits on a steering committee for a multi-state working group on AI. The group includes Republicans and Democrats. We know the federal government just can't act as quickly, and we know how rapidly these technologies are changing, allowing the states to regulate where they're closer to seeing the harms. The Trump administration has previously tried to stop states from enforcing AI regulations. A draft of the Republicans' tax and spending bill this last summer included a moratorium blocking states from passing such laws for 10 years. That proposal ban received considerable backlash from both Republicans and Democratic governors and state officials, and it was ultimately struck down in the Senate in a 99-1 vote. But the debate may not be over. Republican Senator Ted Cruz insisted at a Politico AI and Tech Summit in September that the idea of a 10-year moratorium is not at all dead. As Congress and the administration weigh other ways to curb or altogether halt some regulations, states are moving forward. California Governor Gavin Newsom, for one, has signed more than a dozen AI bills into law in the last 2 years. Including a landmark transparency bill this September that requires large AI companies to disclose how they're implementing safety protocols so that a chatbot can't, for example, give a user instructions on how to build a chemical weapon. New York has advanced a similar law this year. An Illinois law imposed sweeping restrictions on AI use in therapy. And Colorado and Texas have passed bills protecting people from discrimination when AI algorithms are used to make consequential decisions, such as those related to housing or employment. Several experts interviewed by the Monitor said that they expect a significant amount of legislation in the coming year that could establish safety parameters for how bots such as ChatGPT, interact with users, especially children. The lawmakers passing these bills say they're necessary to address challenges that people are already facing from AI technologies. But some experts and lawmakers fear the laws will have unintended side effects. In a September congressional hearing, Representative Daryl Issa of California warned of a patchwork of indecision. If each state is passing its own laws, he said, companies could face a tangled web of conflicting laws and regulations. Many Republicans and technology leaders fear that sorting through these standards could create cost barriers, hindering AI innovation for businesses and developers. That would come at a time when the U.S. is closely competing with China to see who will emerge as an AI leader and the ability to shape AI algorithms and applications. When you have 50 different states creating potentially 50 different sets of rules, some of which could even end up being in conflict with one another, that creates such a regulatory nightmare, said Patrick Hedger, the director of policy at NetChoice, a trade association advocating for free enterprise on the Internet. Travis Hall, the director of state engagement for the nonprofit Center for Democracy and Technology, doesn't see this patchwork argument actually playing out, at least so far. He says many of the laws passed address specific industries, such as healthcare, that are already regulated under state law. And the ability to target local industries is one of the reasons he believes AI regulations should be implemented at the local level. A recent Tennessee law called the Elvis Act, for example, protects against the use of AI to impersonate musicians' voices. Mr. Hall says the law makes sense for a state like Tennessee, where Elvis Presley grew up and made his home, that values its musicians. I have had a hard time imagining a federal bill that would really cover the landscape of things that AI touches, he says. As states work to pass these laws, though, the process can be messy. American Enterprise Institute economist Will Reinhart points to problems with Colorado's AI law this year as an example of states overlooking the burdens that can fall on businesses. Although the law protecting against discrimination was signed in 2024, the state's Democratic Governor Jared Polis, who supported a 10-year moratorium on state regulation, responded to objections from tech groups about its potential impact by delaying implementation until June 2026. For example, under the initial law, AI developers could be held responsible if their algorithms caused discrimination, regardless of the developer's intent. Mr. Reinhart, for one, says he supports the nice big overall idea of trying to give people protection. But when you get into the nitty-gritty of the laws, he adds, implementing a specific regulation can be very difficult. Senator Maroney in Connecticut is working with lawmakers in other states who are trying to take on such challenges. The group of over 100 state lawmakers meets twice a month to discuss bills and share resources. Senator Maroney says this idea sharing helps maintain consistency, avoiding the patchwork problem that many fear. The way forward is working together, he says. Our next article is You Get Centered and Pray, Eddie Murphy documentary looks at comedians' inspiration, by Ken Macon, cultural commentator. The essence of the Eddie Murphy documentary, Big Being Eddie, now streaming on Netflix, is baked into the title. I'm an artist who can express myself in different ways, Mr. Murphy says, during a seminal moment in the film. I'm not trying to be or to get to, I just am. In some ways, it reminds me of guilty pleasures of mine, DJ Callan's Party, the not-so-radio-friendly sampling of Mr. Murphy's classic single, Party All the Time. The 2022 record also features Migos members Quavo and the late Takeoff. DJ Khaled was a producer and hype man. Quavo was the front man for the song, while Takeoff was the behind-the-scenes genius. Mr. Murphy is all of those things. Producer, leading man, and the brains behind countless operations. To quote a movie from the same year, he is everything, everywhere, all at once. He famously started out with impressions of Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby, which he parlayed into a stand-up career and a coveted spot on Saturday Night Live. His refusal to be typecast is what made him legendary and also changed the way Hollywood perceived black actors. Mr. Murphy's career-altering star turn as Reggie Hammond in 48 Hours was a resounding box office success that gave him pop and crossover appeal. So how does a man with so much ability and appeal find his center? Mr. Murphy's answers and perspectives are what define this documentary. When things are all messed up, you get centered and pray, he says. It's like a tuning fork. You hit it and it's vibrating. Then you can take it and run your fingers down the fork and it stops vibrating. That's what prayer is like. Even when discussing balance, he's seeking a center. I don't want to sound all guru-ish, he says, with a light chuckle, one far different from the uproarious laughter that defined his career. He's so leveled, offers Kenan Thompson of Saturday Night Live and Nickelodeon fame. Mr. Thompson's words are a reminder that being Eddie is about more than one man. It's about the lineage of black comedians. From Mr. Pryor to Mr. Murphy to Dave Chappell, Chris Rock, and many others, Mr. Murphy's return to Saturday Night Live after a years-long feud was less about the show and more about the comedian's inspiration to a generation, which included SNL alums such as Tracy Morgan and Mr. Thompson. The remembrance even gave light to the usually sardonic Mr. Chappell, who glowingly spoke about his hero and his star turn in The Nutty Professor, where Mr. Murphy famously played Sherman Klump, as well as all of the members of the Klump family. While early reviews of Being Eddie praised the recollection of Mr. Murphy's career, they also were critical of how the Netflix special was manicured and left out some of the controversy in his past. It's understandable that folks would want a more definitive outline of Mr. Murphy's life and legacy, but that's not the intention here. Sensitivity is the gauge, not just how much talent you have, the comedian offers in the film. The most sensitive one will be the artist that's the most in tune. Maybe that's why the DJ Khaled and Migos song lands for me, because it's a reminder of the good times before your loved ones became tributes. Quavo misses Takeoff. I miss my brother, Mr. Murphy misses his older brother, the late Charlie Murphy, whose true Hollywood stories were a staple of the Chappell's show. Above all else, this movie is a tribute, and not just to Mr. Murphy's individual brilliance. It's a tribute to his parents, including his pugilist stepfather, whom he said changed his life. It's a tribute to comedians all over the spectrum, from influences like Red Fox to modern-day mimickers such as Pete Davidson. And ultimately, it's a tribute to family, from his children to characters, our hero befriended along the way, such as singer Val Young. Perhaps this documentary will be a springboard to Mr. Murphy revisiting his stand-up career and iconic highlights such as Delirious and Raw. Maybe it's not, and that's fine too. It stands alone as an example on what to do with one's energy. Protecting it is essential, but there is great power in sharing it with the world. And Mr. Murphy, with his reputation of being a jack of all trades, has mastered this idea as well. Being Eddie is rated R for language throughout, sexual references, and brief nudity. Children's cafeterias nourish a sense of community across Japan. By Takahiko Kambayushi, contributed. Nagoya, Kobe, and Kawagoe, Japan. Fried chicken is on the menu, so the children let out a cheer. Preschoolers and primary school students are filing into children's cafeteria Kyuchan for a hot dinner in a bustling district of Nagoya in central Japan. The glass-walled cafeteria is welcoming and kid-friendly, with a spacious open kitchen and an aquarium stocked with colorful tropical fish. Meals here are well-balanced and very, very delicious, 9-year-old Hasegawa Ichikaya says with a broad smile while picking up vegetables with her chopsticks. We also get fruit and dessert. Every weekday for more than 5 years, the cafeteria has provided free or low-cost home-style meals to children and other members of the community. The number of such cafeterias, also known as ibasho, or places where one feels accepted, have increased exponentially nationwide in the past decade. There were 10,867 in the previous fiscal year, up from 319 in fiscal 2016, according to data cited by Musubi, a network that supports these mostly private sector initiatives. The cafeterias are run by parents and nonprofit groups and staffed by armies of volunteer cooks and servers, including retirees and college students. Many cafeterias also distribute rice and produce to needy families. The Ibasho surge comes as grocery prices rise in Japan and as residents struggle to cope with isolation and loneliness. Q Holdings Corporation, a local funeral service provider, operates the Kuchan Cafeteria with the help of a wide array of volunteers, including a barber, a professional wrestler, violinists, and traditional tea ceremony practitioners. Food donations come from across Japan, says Fujie Yumiko, Kuchan's chief chef. Thankfully, we receive corn from Hokkaido, vegetables from Takayama, and tuna from Okinawa, she says. Supporters say you need these donations because you run the cafeteria 5 days a week. At the Mutual Support Network, a children's cafeteria in the western city of Kobe, non-agenarian Murakami Sata volunteers to teach children origami after lunch, while university students and retired teachers tutor primary students and middle schoolers. Many cafeterias have therefore been a hub for multi-generational exchange, which operators say helps children's social development. Yusa Makuto, a prominent anti-poverty activist and the founder of Musubi, is behind the nationwide expansion of children's cafeterias. He says his group appreciates a groundswell of support from farmers and companies as they continue to donate rice despite inflation. In provincial areas, many cafeterias have never bought rice thanks to such donations, Mr. Yuasha says. At Mizora Children's Cafeteria in Kobe, dozens of children and some parents have hot meals in the 880-square-foot straw-matted room twice a month. Nakayama Yu says her preschool-aged daughter, Yuri, has a pretty good appetite when eating with many others here. Yuri also likes the cross-cultural events organized by university student volunteers. Asai Kazuko launched the cafeteria in 2019 to help ease the burden on working parents and keep children from eating alone. Mr. Asahi says some of the mothers who came to the cafeteria confided to her a number of complex problems, including their children's school absenteeism. So she has invited experts to Misora to speak to mothers, educators, and care workers. Japan's government set up an office to address loneliness and isolation in 2021, as these issues worsened during the COVID-19 pandemic. The number of children who died by suicide hit a record high of 529 in 2024, the worst among the group of seven industrialized countries, according to Japan's Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. Overall suicide figures, however, have declined. Japanese mothers who shoulder the lion's share of raising children tend to be isolated as more people get less involved with communities and even their relatives, says Yonida Shakiko, a consultant with the Children's Future Support Office in Yokohama. Ms. Yonida, who also teaches at Kanto Gakuin University, recalls she had a feeling of stagnation while raising her own children. So did children in my community, which drove me to act, she said. Koike Manami, the head of nonprofit in Kawagoe, north of Tokyo, first established a children's cafeteria in May of 2023. Now she runs three sites and also organizes games and plays for child-rearing families. It takes a community to raise a child, Ms. Kiyoki says. I would like every member of a community to give lots of love to children. Mr. Uwasa says children's cafeterias have also helped rebuild communities as they create opportunities for locals to interact with one another. Gyodo Kazuyoshi agrees. He leads the nonprofit group Hinabotoko in the town of Shirinaka in Hokkaido, about 550 miles northeast of Tokyo. Like many other rural areas in Japan, Shirinaka faces an aging society and depopulation. Mr. Gido started a children's cafeteria in 2019 after severe illness kept him from working for 11 years. During my recuperation, I made up my mind to do something for others, the octogenarian recalls. Social connections are absolutely necessary for these children. Every Sunday, volunteers in their 70s and 80s cook lunch for children and older residents, while a group distributes bento boxes to more than 130 single-parent households 3 times a month. Other residents also volunteer to tutor children, he says. Back in Kuichan, Mr. Fuji, a flamenco dancer who has 2 grown daughters, wants the cafeteria's work to have lasting effects. My hope is that when these children grow up and remember this place, she says, they'll decide to give something back to their communities. And that brings us to the end of today's edition of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.